Good afternoon and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the findings from 50 State Medicaid Budget Survey for state fiscal years 2009-2010. At this time, I would like to inform you that this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, September 30th, 2009. All participants will be on a listen-only mode until the question and answer session. However, at any point during the presentation, if you have a question, you may indicate so by pressing the pound key followed by the number 3 on your push-button keypad. Your questions will be then queued for the question and answer period. It is now my pleasure to introduce and turn the call over to Ms. Diane Rowland. Please go ahead.
Hello and welcome. It's a pleasure to be here once again to talk about Medicaid and state budgets and what's happening. The message may not be as pleasant as we want it to be, but it's at least useful to take an assessment of where we are. And welcome to all of you who have either joined us by phone or by being with us here in D.C. I'm really pleased that this is the ninth year that we are releasing this survey, so we really do have the ability to track changes over time in terms of where the states have been with Medicaid and their budgets, and to look at how this year will go forward in terms of the choices states are making. This really is an attempt to provide an in-depth look at both the choices and challenges that face states in their efforts to cover the low-income population for both their health and long-term care needs amid one of the deepest recessions we have ever known. Before we begin with the findings, I wanted to thank, as always, the Medicaid directors and their staff in all 50 states who year after year provide the detail and the information that enables us to do this survey, and I'm very pleased that we're able in every case to have all 50 states participating, so there's no issue that leaves any state out. I'd also like to thank, of course, our partners in this for the last 9 years, the Health Management Associates team, Vern Smith, Kathleen Gifford, and Eileen Ellis, as well as the KFS team that works with them, Robin Rudowitz, Molly O'Malley-Watts, Karen Mark, and Barbara Lyons. I think this is really a great opportunity for those of you who are trying to cover health reform and other issues to at least take an in-depth look at where we are with one of our major healthcare programs today. So that we'll begin by having Robin Rudowitz and Vern Smith provide an overview of the major findings in the report that we're releasing today. And then we're going to turn to two state perspectives to really give you the ability to see how these issues are playing out specifically in two states. Chuck Duarte, the administrator for the Division of Healthcare Financing and Policy in the Nevada Department of Health and Human Services, and Deborah Backrath, the New York State Medicaid Director and Deputy Commissioner of the Office of Health Insurance Programs for the State of New York, will both be on the phone and able to provide some initial reactions to the report itself, as well as to answer the questions when we open up the phones in the room for your comments. So to get us started, there are slides that are available for those of you who are tuning in that have been posted on the website, as well as in the packets for those who are in the room today. So I'm going to turn it over to Robin to start us off on highlighting some of the key issues.
Thanks, Diane, and welcome, everybody. Before we jump into the findings from this year's survey, I just wanted to provide a brief overview of the Medicaid program, because we know Medicaid has really multiple roles in the healthcare system. Its primary role is to provide healthcare coverage to nearly 60 million low-income Americans, including 30 million children, 15 million adults, mostly their children, their parents, 14 million elderly, and people with disabilities. Beyond coverage, Medicaid also helps the Medicare program work for nearly 9 million low-income Medicare beneficiaries for providing help in paying for premiums and cost-sharing and also providing wraparound coverage. Medicaid pays for long-term care supports for about 1 million people in nursing homes and another 2.8 million people with long-term care needs in the community. In total, Medicaid represents about $1 in $6 spent in the whole healthcare system and 40% of all long-term care spending. Medicaid provides matching funds for states to support coverage, so while Medicaid is a major budget item for states, it is also a large revenue source of federal revenues for states. While many of you already know this, it's important to remember that while children and their parents make up 3/4 of the program's enrollees, they make up only 30% of the program's costs, and the elderly and people with disabilities make up a much smaller share of the enrollees, but a much larger percentage of the cost because they tend to have higher acute care needs and also utilize expensive long-term care services and supports. We know that the recession has had a huge impact on state budgets as well as state Medicaid programs across the country, and we know from our work conducted with the Urban Institute that there is, in fact, a direct relationship between unemployment, state revenues, and health care coverage. When people lose their jobs, they lose their job-based coverage, and while children may then gain coverage through Medicaid or CHIP, many adults wind up uninsured. Increases in unemployment also result in decreases in state revenue, resulting in a real crunch for states. So while demand for services and programs like Medicaid rise, it's at a time when states can least afford to pay for it. Since the start of the recession, unemployment has increased from a rate, the national unemployment rate has increased from 4.9% in December 2007 to 9.7% in August 2009, and we're expecting new updated numbers this Friday on September unemployment rate. These figures would translate into nearly 5 million more enrollees in Medicaid and CHIP and just over 5 million more people without insurance in the country. The recession has also resulted in record declines in state revenue. Census data shows that for the first quarter of 2009, state tax revenues declined by about 11.8% from the same period in 2008. And there was new data just released that shows a further decline of about 17% for the second quarter. There are also estimates that show states are facing budget shortfalls that could total at least $350 billion for the rest of 2010 and through 2011. Recognizing the dire fiscal situation, Congress enacted and the President signed the ARRA, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, in early February. The largest element of state fiscal relief was an estimated $90 billion from a temporary increase in the federal share of Medicaid costs from October 2008 through the end of 2010. All states got an increase in their federal matching rates, and states with higher increases in their unemployment got additional relief. However, to be eligible for these Medicaid ARRA funds, states had to meet certain requirements. Importantly, states could not restrict their eligibility levels or make it more difficult to enroll in the program. Byrne will discuss some of the key impacts of ARRA in his remarks. And the next slide really just shows the effect of the enhanced ARRA matching funds, showing that 9 states now have federal contributions for their Medicaid programs at 78% or higher. So with that set up, I'll send it over to Byrne.
Well, thank you, Robin, and thank you, Diane. I am Byrne Smith, and I'm very pleased to be here today to share with you the results of our 9th annual Medicaid budget survey that we do in conjunction with the Kaiser Family Foundation. And I simply have to add my acknowledgement that Diane offered to the co-authors here, Robin and Karen, who are here at the table with us, and Molly, Kathy Gifford, and Eileen Ellis, who are on the phone. And second, I also have to extend thanks to the Medicaid directors in all 50 states. Every state, as Diane said, completed the survey, and in a time of budget staff shortages, we're especially grateful this year for that. The survey was conducted in the first 60 days of the new state fiscal year, 2010, with updates through the end of last week. It's important that I say that because last week wasn't long enough to capture all the changes. Michigan is finalizing its budget today, and I'll mention in a place or two where that would change the results. So at this critical time, the purpose of the survey is to identify and track the trends in Medicaid across the states and spending and enrollment, what states are doing to control spending or to expand coverage, and what the key issues and concerns are and where Medicaid is headed in the future. Aside from the economy, the most significant force shaping Medicaid in 2009 was the federal stimulus package, the Recovery Act. States received Recovery Act funding for 9 months, in fiscal year 2009, totaling $29 billion, of which 90%, $26 billion, came through Medicaid, through the enhanced Medicaid matching rate. Without the federal stimulus funding, the Medicaid story in 2009 would have been dramatically different. Without any doubt, we would have seen widespread cuts to eligibility, and cuts to benefits and provider payment rates would have been much, much more severe. Without the enhanced Medicaid matching funds, 29 states said they would have cut eligibility, including 14 states that reversed already adopted eligibility restrictions to qualify for the ARRA funding. Clearly, the federal stimulus funds preserve Medicaid coverage for millions of current beneficiaries across the country. 36 states avoided cuts in benefits. 38 states enacted rate cuts that were smaller than would have occurred or avoided provider rate cuts altogether due to the stimulus funding. In addition, 44 states said that federal stimulus funds that went to Medicaid and were used for Medicaid freed up state dollars that helped to reduce or even close the state general fund shortfall. Now, looking at spending and enrollment, a year ago when fiscal 2009 began for states, states had initially projected Medicaid spending would increase by 5.8% on average. Instead, as the economy worsened, total Medicaid spending increased on average by 7.9%, the highest rate of growth in total spending since 2003. The primary driver of Medicaid spending for 2009 was the growth in the number of persons enrolled in the program. A year ago, state officials had expected enrollment to increase by 3.6%. However, as more people lost their jobs and lost their health coverage, more people became eligible. Actual enrollment growth was half again larger than projected, averaging 5.4%. Significantly, many states said the pace of enrollment growth accelerated as the year went on, with the largest increases of the year occurring in April, May, and June, the last 3 months of the fiscal year. Coming into the current fiscal year, 2010, state officials expect growth in the number of persons on Medicaid to continue to accelerate. Across all states, enrollment is now projected to grow this year on average by 6.6%. This would be the largest rate of growth in Medicaid enrollment in 8 years, going back to 2002 and the depths of the last recession. However, looking at spending growth, we see an anomalous situation. As adopted by state legislatures, spending growth in fiscal year 2010 was appropriated to increase on average by 6.3%. In other words, on average, Medicaid spending was appropriated to grow slightly less fast than enrollment. This would be highly unusual, since typically spending growth exceeds enrollment growth by 2 to 3 percentage points. We interpret this to mean that state budget shortfalls were so large and state revenue drops so deep that state general funds simply were not available for legislatures to authorize overall Medicaid spending growth that could even match growth and expected enrollment. Even with the enhanced federal matching rate, states still need to come up with the state dollars to draw down the federal matching dollars, and they couldn't do that because state budgets are in such difficulty. Indeed, in three-fourths of the states, state officials told us that the likelihood of a Medicaid budget shortfall in this fiscal year was at least 50-50. The severity of the state budget situation is underscored when you look at what happened to the state share of total Medicaid spending, the portion of total Medicaid spending that comes out of state revenues. Last fiscal year, total Medicaid spending increased by 7.9%, but in contrast, the state share dropped by 6.3%. This was the first drop in annual state spending in the history of Medicaid, simply unprecedented. States are still spending significant amounts of state dollars on Medicaid. Medicaid is the second largest program in state budgets in terms of state dollars, but states still need to come up with the state dollars to draw down the federal matching funds. And even at the enhanced federal matching rate, they simply don't have the dollars to do it. Now, the enhanced federal matching rates were in place in fiscal year 2009 for just 9 months, three-fourths of the year. For this year, fiscal year 2010, the enhanced rates are in effect for the full 12 months of the year, so state funds, because of this, are expected to drop again. For fiscal year 2010, state appropriations projected a year-over-year drop in state general fund spending that would average 5.6%. Of course, if overall Medicaid spending this year should actually grow by more than the 6.3% in initial legislative appropriations, as we might expect, the drop in state spending would be less, and it could be substantially less. Looking now at state policy actions in fiscal year 2009 and 2010, state policymakers are doing all they can to constrain the growth in Medicaid spending, and they're at the same time trying their best to minimize the impacts on beneficiaries and providers. A number of states enacting policies to constrain Medicaid cost total 46 in fiscal year 09 and 47 in fiscal year 10. Now, the ARRA precluded cuts in eligibility, so states did not have this arrow in their quiver. Out of necessity, states looked instead to restrictions on benefits and provider payments. 10 states restricted benefits last year, and 15 states for this year, fiscal year 2010. Most of these restrictions were, in fact, restrictions and not eliminations of coverage. For example, there were limits on over-the-counter medications or new prior authorization requirements on selected services. But significant benefit cuts did occur in a few states, such as Michigan, California, and Utah. Last year, for example, Michigan eliminated coverage for adults for dental care, vision services, eyeglasses, hearing aids, podiatry, and chiropractic services. Utah eliminated coverage for occupational, physical, and speech therapies, eyeglasses, and chiropractic services. For this year, California's Medi-Cal program eliminated coverage for a number of services, including dental, audiology, speech, vision, and eyeglasses, podiatry, chiropractic, and psychology services. Now, looking at long-term care, we see a slightly different picture. States continue to adopt policies to encourage care in the home and community, but because of the budget, fewer states were able to expand their waiver programs to do so, and more states placed restrictions on existing home or community benefits, such as new limits on the number of home visits. By far, the most significant approach to cost control has been cuts or freezes to provider payment rates. Last year, a total of 39 states cut or froze payment rates. For this year, fiscal year 10, the report shows a total of 39 states enacted cuts or further cuts, and we know further cuts were under consideration in other states. And this is where I mentioned Michigan. The agreement reached last night in the Michigan legislature and expected to be adopted later today would cut provider rates pretty much across the board by an additional 4%. Looking at the table graph that shows changes in provider payment rate changes, notice the dramatic change from just a couple years ago. The change from fiscal year 2008, when 35 states increased hospital rates, to this year, fiscal year 2010, when 33 states cut or froze payment rates. Nursing homes went from 46 states where payment rates increased in fiscal year 2008 to 26 states that cut or froze rates in fiscal year 2010. In many states, the most difficult rate cut would be for doctors. Several states increased rates in recent years for doctors and dentists specifically to improve provider participation and access in Medicaid. In fiscal year 2008, over half the states increased physician payment rates, and only one state had a cut, and that was a limited one. However, in this year, fiscal year 2010, only 9 states were able to increase rates for doctors, and 13 states actually cut doctor-provider payment rates. That would be 14 now with Michigan. Looking at pharmacy, over the past decade, states have enacted a broad range of cost controls that have dramatically slowed the pace of cost growth for prescribed drugs. Almost all states now have a specific list of preferred drugs. They've negotiated supplemental rebates in addition to those mandated in federal law. They've joined multi-state purchasing pools, adopted maximum allowable cost limits on generic products, and a number of other actions, including fraud and abuse. In fiscal year 2009 and 2010, almost all states indicated they expanded or fine-tuned these policies to make them more effective. Looking at managed care, except for Alaska and Wyoming, every state now has some form of managed care, and about two-thirds of Medicaid beneficiaries receive some or all of their care through a managed care delivery system. In fiscal year 2009 and in 2010, states continue to enhance these systems of care by adding geographic service areas eligibility groups are moving from voluntary to mandatory enrollment. A number of states are also moving to apply the principles of managed care in the long-term care arena. Through managed care, states focus on quality measurement and improvement. Quality improvement is becoming a strong suit for state Medicaid programs. They use specific performance and utilization measures, and over two-thirds of states now have some form of performance-based reimbursement designed to improve quality. Now, states are increasingly using information technology to improve the efficiency, safety, and quality of care. Two specific ways to do so are electronic prescribing and electronic medical or health records. In 2009 and 2010, there's been a dramatic uptick in the number of states participating in health information technology initiatives, in part because of Medicaid transformation grants, which provided $150 million to states through the DRA a couple years ago, and more recently, the federal stimulus funding, which has authorized $19 billion over 5 years, and that money is just beginning to flow. Medicaid programs sometimes lead these initiatives, but more often they're participating as part of a broader statewide effort. The number of states participating in electronic prescribing or electronic health record or medical record initiatives has increased very substantially over the last 2 years. Looking now into the future, Medicaid directors listed three primary issues they see over the next year. First, Medicaid directors expressed concern that Medicaid cost pressures will continue long after the recession ends, and after back-to-back recessions, they struggle to find new ways to control the growth in Medicaid spending. The second issue is this: what will states do when the enhanced federal matching rate ends in December of 2010, just 15 months away? Reverting to the regular federal matching rate will cause the state share of Medicaid spending to spike. The concerns we heard about what could happen then went far beyond anything we have heard previously from states. Medicaid directors talked of, quote, unthinkable cuts. Clearly, unless state revenues rebound very quickly or some form of enhanced federal matching is extended, states will be making some very, very difficult decisions fiscal year 2011. The third issue is federal health reform. All of the proposals now being considered in Congress envision an expanded role for Medicaid. State officials said they are confident that Medicaid would provide excellent health coverage for low-income uninsured who could become Medicaid eligible. They are concerned about how the new coverage might be financed, and they know there will be added administrative burdens, but if those issues are addressed, Medicaid directors indicated their programs could do the jobs that Congress may propose for them. With that, let me stop, and maybe we can turn to the Medicaid directors who are on the line.
Certainly. Let's turn to you, Chuck Duarte in Nevada, for your observations and updates.
Well, thanks a lot, and I appreciate the presentation. I think you folks have done a great summary of some of the issues affecting a number of states, and I think particularly Nevada. As most of you probably know, Nevada is experiencing a significant downturn, and we're not one of those states that have expanded our program over the years. We've been very dependent on employer-based insurance, means of covering our citizens, and it's been very effective up until now. We're seeing a growing number of unemployed who are going to soon be exhausting their unemployment benefits and coming back on to Medicaid. And so we're very concerned about current enrollment growth, but also future enrollment growth once the additional 13-week extension for employment benefits run out. I think just in general terms, you know, we're seeing the trajectories of our enrollment growth as well as our revenue all going in the wrong direction. Our legislature closed in June. We have a biennial legislature and budget, and they closed our budget in June, and we're already over budgeted in terms of caseload and spending. And it's compounded by the problem of revenue shortfalls being projected that weren't considered even in June, just a few months ago when the budget was closed. So we're looking at the compounding effects of increasing caseloads and declining revenues. And I think, you know, the issues that Vern identified in terms of what we're facing in the near term within the next year to 2 years are very accurate. We're looking at several cliffs. These are, you know, the precipices that we're looking at are related to the run out on the ERA increased FMAP funds. Nevada is one of those states that are in the highest tier of FMAP increases. Our current federal match rate is 63.93%, but we're looking at that going away and having to deal with a $240 million revenue shortfall associated with the loss of those federal funds. Additionally, the state's will have to borrow significant sums to continue our unemployment benefit programs, and that will have to be repaid to the federal government. And then compounded by the fact that we're seeing continued growth in caseload, right now we're at 13.2% in terms of an unemployment rate. That's an increase from 12.5% just a month ago. We're anticipating that will continue to grow. The unofficial unemployment rate I've heard in Nevada is around 19%, and that includes individuals who've given up looking for work. So with caseload growth increases, and we're also anticipating further declines in state revenues. So there are going to have to be some very, very difficult choices, and I think a lot of that is limited by the fact that the Recovery Act has a maintenance of eligibility provision in it that will restrict our ability from limiting eligibility to the program, and so we'll have to look at sort of the more conventional ways of dealing with shortfalls, looking at provider payments, service levels, and using those tools that are available to us, still available to us, to try to constrain costs.
Okay. And Deborah Bacra, the view from New York State.
Unfortunately, the view from New York doesn't look very different than the national view or the view that Chuck has just described in Nevada. Our fiscal situation is bleak. We're on an April 1 fiscal year, and in this year we closed a $20 billion budget deficit. We're looking at a $7 billion deficit for the fiscal year beginning April 1, 2010. The increased FMAP under ARRA goes away in our 11-12 fiscal year, this year's $7 billion projected deficit jumps to $13 billion. We, like Nevada, are at the highest levels in terms of additional federal matching dollars, and so we've gone from a 50% match to a 61% match, and again, that will goes back down at the end of 2010, causing our deficit to jump. Like other states, we used the increased federal matching dollars to reduce our general fund shortfall, to mitigate but not eliminate reductions in provider rates, and to help pay for the increase in enrollment. Enrollment in both Medicaid and Child Health Plus has been going up steadily for the last 18 months. Before that, it has been flat or even going down slightly. In terms of cost growth, we're right at the national average for looking at a 7.9% increase in Medicaid costs this year. That compares with 1.5% last year. New York, because Medicaid is a significant payer in New York, we began reform initiatives 3 years ago, both seeking to simplify our enrollment process, and as we covered more people to be able to afford that, to reform our payment policies so that we were buying quality, cost-effective care. So that while ARRA would have prevented us from cutting coverage, that was not part of New York's agenda. We worked hard and have been for 3 years now to reform our payment methodologies, and our payment cuts were done at the same time that we reformed the methodology to increase transparency and accountability. We reduced payment levels in every sector but ambulatory care, and over the last 2 years, we have taken over $500 million out of inpatient rates and invested that in hospital clinics, community health centers, and physician fees. So there have been no cuts in our ambulatory care sector, and for both hospital clinics and community health centers, we are paying at a reasonable cost level now. Our physician fees, although we've increased them dramatically by more than 50%, we still are not at Medicare levels, and that is one of the goals that may be shortchanged as a result of the plummeting resources. At the same time, in an effort to, again, ensure that we're buying quality, we've introduced a medical home initiative. It will roll out on December 1st of this year, and we will be paying enhanced rates of payments to doctors and clinics who meet NCQA medical home standards. That aligns us, and we think this is critical for Medicaid, with Medicare and private payers in the effort to achieve a more coordinated approach to primary and preventive care. Again, as part of our efforts to contain costs, we have implemented a mammoth retrospective utilization review of over 7 million fee-for-service claims, and we project savings there of over $45 million over the next 3 years. We've implemented selective contracting, where we're looking for providers who are providing more quality, more cost-effective care, and we've started in the areas of breast cancer surgery and bariatric surgery, and we've begun prior authorization programs in radiology. We're focused particularly on our high-need, high-cost populations, and there we are expanding what has been our very successful Medicaid managed care program, and with significant foundation support focusing on our fee-for-service populations with a chronic illness demonstration program. We follow Medicare in the Never Events policy and, again, on preventable readmissions. In terms of long-term care, we've introduced a long-term care assessment center, and we are looking for a stronger federal partner now, and this is critical for our dual eligibles. And I know I speak for all states here. Something like 16% of our Medicaid enrollees are dual, but they constitute 40% of our costs. And we're hopeful we will have a better federal partner here going forward. For New York, when we look at the federal reform proposals, we are extremely concerned about the formulas to provide increased federal matching dollars. The proposals in the Senate bill, and particularly in the chairman's mark, would significantly disadvantage states like New York that have previously expanded coverage. So because we are already, or virtually already, at the 133% eligibility level for both adults and children under Medicaid, we will receive significantly less federal dollars, which will put us in a difficult situation as more and more of our currently eligible but unenrolled come on. In fact, we're looking at increasing the deficit by a minimum of $900 million. One of the things that is particularly encouraging in the chairman's mark is the consistency between Medicaid enrollment procedures and our subsidy populations up to 400, but the administrative challenges that will pose for New York and I suspect other states will be enormous. So at this point, let me stop and turn it back over to Kaiser to pick up at this point.
Terrific. Chuck and Deborah, thank you for your insights, your comments, and especially for the struggles you face every day to keep this program operating as a safety net that it really has become for so many more as this recession has deepened. I think you've heard a lot about the bleakness of the situation out there, the reality that in any recession, enrollment goes up as state revenues go down, and right now the importance of the additional federal financing that came through the ERA legislation, but the concern about the fact that this recession seems to be a very slow one for recovery and almost a jobless recovery by many that would leave the continued pressure on enrollment as people lose both their insurance coverage and their income that puts them below the eligibility levels for coverage under Medicaid. So it is a challenging time, and the end of the federal assistance is probably going to be sooner than most states would want to have and weather. But we've let you listen to a range of presentations. I'm going to open it up to questions first to see if any of the reporters in the room want to raise a question, and then to turn to the phones if we have questions on the phone. So if you would please just identify yourself quickly when you ask a question, we'll start right here.
Hi, Doug Trapp with American Medical News. Just to put things in perspective, if there was a recovery starting now, how long would it be before states actually felt less pressure on their Medicaid programs?
Well, history has shown that state revenues lag recovery from recession by a year or two. And so states would not typically expect to see their revenues begin to increase again for quite some time. I think this is the issue that the Medicaid directors referred to when they expressed their concern about the financial situation going forward, that even if the recovery were beginning right now, and even if it were somewhat robust right now, that the state revenues that would be sufficient to fund the program would be quite some time coming.
But no one's predicting anything like that happening. You've heard of
it. No one, exactly. So it may be an extended period of time beyond a year or two.
This is Chuck Duar from Nevada. I want to add to what Vern's talking about. Historically, what we've seen is that in prior recessions, we've seen enrollment linger at levels reached during a recession for about 18 to 24 months before it starts to decline when the economy picks up. Whether or not the enrollees that we're picking up now are going to be more responsive to a change in the economy, that is, that they'll get back into the labor force more quickly, I don't know. But we do see that lingering caseload phenomenon occur, and we're very concerned about that, as well as the fact that states that like Nevada, which have a significant dependence on discretionary income spending, that we will lag behind any kind of economic recovery across the nation. So we are anticipating that there's going to be continued problems even as the economy improves.
Yeah, the Medicaid enrollment increases when people lose their jobs and then lose their health insurance. And when the economy begins to recover, those folks don't just automatically reclaim the jobs that they lost. And if they do get another job, the job may not have health coverage. So it does take a long time before Medicaid sees the effects of a recovery.
Okay. Jerry.
Yeah, hi. I have a question for Ms. Bachrach. As I look through the report, and particularly the appendices.
Jerry, could you identify yourself?
Oh, yeah. Hi. Jerry Zaremski from the Buffalo News. As I look through the appendices especially, I get the sense that New York, to some degree, extended coverage, extended benefits at a time when some states were doing the opposite because of the fiscal constraints they were facing. So I was wondering if you could tell me the fiscal impact of the extensions of coverage and benefits that New York State made during this time, and what the rationale was for those expansions.
The New York, since 2007, as you rightly point out, has pursued a strategy. It's really a dual strategy of expanding coverage, and probably the most significant was raised our Child Health Plus levels from 250% of the federal poverty level to 400%, and we also raised eligibility levels for 19 and 20-year-olds in Medicaid from 100 to 160% of the federal poverty level. At the same time, we streamlined the enrollment and renewal process because we identified that over half of our uninsured were eligible for public programs and not enrolled, and we were confronting a churn rate, in other words, individuals who were eligible falling off of coverage of about 40% a year. I can't give you the specific dollar implications of the new folks coming on. I can tell you that the first impact, and it's hit first children in the new CPS data, our number of uninsured children has gone down dramatically, so that we know that when we cover people, they will get their care earlier in less expensive settings. So that was the commitment New York made and to date has maintained.
I would get the sense, though, that with the state under this kind of fiscal pressure, you would have some idea of the fiscal ramifications of the changes that you made. Can't you just give us a ballpark or some sort of indication of how much it costs to do this?
Jerry, I don't have those figures with me. Afterwards you can follow up with our press office, and I'll work with Division of the Budget, and we can talk about the new enrollees that came on under this expansion effort. But I would point out again that whether we cover somebody from insurance or if we leave them uninsured, what happens is they end up in our hospital emergency rooms sicker, and where we admit them to inpatient care, which is much more expensive than treating them with coverage in a primary care setting.
Okay, next question.
Yeah, Joyce Frieden from Internal Medicine News. I guess this question is mostly for Mr. Duarte because it sounds like New York has kind of held the line on provider rates, but and also for Mr. Smith. But I'm wondering if there have been cuts in the provider rates to Medicaid, how has it affected things in terms of providers dropping out of the program or not seeing Medicaid patients?
Yeah, thank you for the question. We have maintained over the years a relatively high level of professional reimbursement, actually in aggregate exceeding the Medicare reimbursement levels. A lot of that was associated with payment enhancements for children, for obstetrics and kinds of specialties. During a couple of special sessions that preceded our regular legislative session, we reduced physician payments and eliminated specifically the enhancements for pediatric care and for obstetrics. In looking at provider enrollment, knock on wood, we've not seen an impact. We still maintain about contracts with about 93% of licensed physicians in the state, and about 65% of those indicate that they're still seeing new recipients. That was from a survey that we conducted earlier in the calendar year. So to date, we've not seen any issues associated with access.
Can I just clarify, New York did cut provider rates, not in the ambulatory sector, but on nursing homes, home care, and inpatient and pharmacy.
And has that had any impact in terms of access?
No. We monitored very carefully. We have not seen an impact on access, and we are working very hard with our physician community to enroll more physicians into Medicaid.
Now we'd like to turn to a question from the telephone.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, for the participants that are on the audio portion of today's call, if you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing any numbers. Should you have a question, please press the pound key followed by the number 3 on your push-button telephone. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by again pressing pound 3. One moment while we compile a list of questions. Our first question comes from Kevin Sack of the New York Times. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, everybody. This is directed at the two state directors. I wanted to confirm the numbers that you used of what your gap will be once the FMAP enhancement is eliminated. Mr. Duarte, I think you said $240 million, and Ms. Bachrach, did you say $6 billion would be the addition?
We are projecting an 11-12 budget deficit of $13 billion. In the current state fiscal year, the enhanced FMAP was worth $5 billion. So that $5 billion is a 12-month number. We'll receive slightly less for the fiscal year that begins April 1st because the enhanced dollars will end at the end of December 2010.
So your FMAP increase is about $5 billion.
Yes, and we project $11 billion over the entire 27-month period.
And,
but I think more significantly, I'll just say one more thing. Think of it this way. Right now, our federal matching rate is 50%. With the enhanced dollars, it jumps to 61%.
Right.
So for every dollar we spend, we're now getting 61 cents of support from the federal government.
And Mr. Dworkin,
that goes away.
And it was the $240 million...
Yes,
correct.
That's the current fiscal biennium that we're in, and we're estimating a $240 million offset to state spending associated with the ARRA funds.
That's a one-year number, 240?
No, that's actually a two-year biennial figure, so it runs from July 1st, 2009 through December 31st of 2010, when the recession adjustment period ends.
Right. And then if I could get each to follow up, I mean, I'm interested in you talking a little bit about what might have to be done to accommodate that kind of shortfall. You know, the report talks about the cuts being unthinkable. I guess I'd like our readers to start thinking about them a little bit. Can you define what the options might be to hit that kind of number?
Sure, I'll go ahead and start. You know, during our last legislative session, we prepared a list of reduction options for consideration by the legislature, and, you know, fortunately, the ARRA funds came in time that we were able to not have to implement some of the most egregious types of cuts. And essentially, what we will have to look at, assuming that there aren't any other kinds of revenue sources coming in, we'll have to look at wholesale elimination of eligibility groups after the ARRA adjustment period. And where the big spending occurs are in categories that are that involve the aged and the elderly. And so we'll have to look at changes in eligibility that might affect clients coming into our programs that need institutional care. Likewise, we'll have to look at changes in eligibility to families and households that are coming in for TANF-related Medicaid. So there's some significant areas that we'd have to look at that we did propose previously to the legislature, but fortunately did not have to take action on. Additionally, we'd have to look at elimination of certain types of optional benefits. Some of these might include the significant expansion of home and community-based benefits that we offered over the last 6 years, where we've seen significant growth in spending, as well as provider rates. And so, you know, a further review of hospital rates as well as professional reimbursements will have to be done, keeping in mind that this could affect access, but we're at the point where that may be a secondary consideration. If we are really going to face some of the revenue shortfalls that we're anticipating as a state.
Well, let me follow up with Chuck. It's really not significantly different in New York. Our three fastest growing areas in Medicaid are home care, personal care, and our home and community-based waivers that are critically important to our developmentally disabled population, our foster care kids, and some of our most seriously mentally ill and chronically ill beneficiaries. So those are our three fastest growing areas, and we have to take a very hard look there. Provider rates have been a target for the last two budgets, and there's been no trend, so that we've held provider rates flat, again, with the exception of our ambulatory care sector, and we've imposed new surcharges already and some additional cuts, some targeted, some across the board. We'll have to go back at the provider rates as well. We have, to this point, been able to protect our eligibility and have not had to cut either eligibility or benefits, and have opted instead for better management. How much longer we'll be able to do that, especially if our initiatives don't bear significant fruit, I don't know. But overall, it's not a pretty picture, even now as we start to look to the 2010-11 budget.
All right. Another question from the phone, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Murphy of the Associated Press. Please state your question.
Hi, thanks. This question was partially answered, so it sounds like the unthinkable eligibility and benefits reduction states may consider would focus basically on narrowing eligibility of certain patient groups where you spend a lot of money, and also reducing provider reimbursement. Is that sort of a correct summary of what that means?
I would just, if you were reacting to my remark, I would just want to clarify that it means looking at this package of services for us, the three, as I said, our three fastest growing are home care, personal care, and home and community-based services, and looking at how do we rationalize those packages and potentially have to cut back on the services. The problem we have is we cut back on home care services or personal care services, are we creating a situation where we're driving our beneficiaries into even more expensive nursing home and nursing homes and institutionalized care? But that has to be the focus because that's where the spending is.
Okay. All right. Chuck, I was aiming more for Chuck. Was that what you were basically saying?
I will ditto what was just said because, you know, what we're facing actually is a cash situation, a cash shortfall situation. And while, you know, all of us are cognizant of the fact that a lot of these initiatives, particularly home-based care, in lieu of institutional care, is the direction that we have to continue going. We've made significant strides in Nevada to expand those options. When you're looking at a cash shortfall, unfortunately, your future returns on investment, your future savings, become less important. And I hate to say that, but that's the fiscal situation that a lot of states are facing. So with that said, you know, we're going to have to look at where we're spending money and have to reduce that. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, management activities, while they are effective in creating savings, the magnitude of the shortfalls that we're looking at cannot be addressed just with more effective management. We're going to have to look seriously at significant reductions.
Okay, and one other quick question. Does anybody see any possibilities for revenue growth anywhere?
Bern?
I think the silence says it all. No.
No.
Okay.
And I think it's very important to remember that when the era of funds disappear at the end of December 2010, so does the requirement that you maintain eligibility in order to receive those funds.
Yeah, next question.
Brian Tumulty from Gannett News Service. So then how does Congress increase Medicaid eligibility to 400% of poverty and expect the states to pay for this?
Well, first of all, the congressional proposals are really to expand Medicaid eligibility to 133% of the federal poverty level and then to subsidize above that.
Okay.
And obviously, that is one of the big issues between the states and the federal government over health care reform. And while the bills deal with it differently, they start at least with federal financing for the increase in enrollment. But I think Deborah can give you some comments about how that affects New York, which is the leader state.
Yes, and that's where we have our concern. New York already covers parents to 160% of the federal poverty level, and we cover childless adults to 100%. The way the chairman's mark would work is that the enhanced FMAP, the enhanced federal dollars, would only be available for populations that are not currently eligible for Medicaid up to 133, so that New York would receive an enhanced matching rate only for our childless adults between 100 and 133%. So in essence, we're being penalized for the decisions we've made in past years to invest state dollars to cover what are really very low-income individuals, those below 133% of the federal poverty level. If we were a state that had not covered childless adults at all, we would receive an enhanced FMAP for that entire population. And I know that I'm always said, well, you know, Congress doesn't want to replace state dollars, but this really isn't a question of replacing state dollars, because I have a million people in this state who are uninsured but eligible for coverage who will come onto the rolls for the first time. That is a good thing, but it is very costly, and with only a 50% federal matching rate and revenues in the state projected to, you know, stay, you know, below 2007 levels for many years to come, I don't know how we put it all together, and we're in the it's not fair camp. There, as I analyze it, there are only two states that are in equally poor positions in terms of enhanced federal dollars. So that's my very New York perspective on that proposal.
And I'll give you my very Nevada perspective as well. Sorry, Deborah.
No, that's fair.
This is Chuck. And I think, you know, we're amongst a group of states that have been quite conservative in terms of the use of Medicaid as a safety net and have not expanded it over the years beyond what are generally the minimum federal requirements. That being said, we are still concerned for the same reasons that Deborah is. Number one is the woodwork effect. And by that I mean that those folks that are uninsured, and there is a growing number of uninsured who are eligible but not enrolled for a variety of reasons. And so we're thinking that could be in the arena of 50 to 70,000 individuals. And those are the groups who, through an individual mandate, if that mandate passes Congress, would be enrolling in the Medicaid program at a match rate that Deborah described at around 50%. So very expensive for us to cover in the future. Additionally, sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room that we're talking about is the fact that there's going to be a lot of administrative costs associated with state Medicaid agencies trying to adapt to these new programs. Some states, like New York and Massachusetts, have moved forward in those areas and are experienced in those types of interfaces with these programs, but other states like Nevada and other states, they are not experienced in that, and it's going to be additional administrative cost. The third concern is, what happens the next time we have an economic recession? I've not seen anything in the bill that really accommodates the fact that, you know, we'll likely see a future recession, and in that case, what in the current discussions will serve as a economic safety valve for states that don't have the dollars to continue their commitments to the populations that enroll as a result of health reform. Keep in mind, we're all for health reform. I think every state Medicaid director is for it because we understand the impact of the uninsured on our programs as well as on employer-sponsored insurance. And so we'd like to see that reform happen. Also have a fiduciary concern about what this might mean to the state, not just 5 years from now, but down the road when we have another economic problem.
Morning, Robbie with Gannett. Just following up on the reimbursement rate issue, can you explain why there's such a difference in what states get from the federal government, what percent? I know that the stimulus bill, states got a bigger share based on their unemployment rates, but in general, why is there a variation on what states are getting, and would that change under the
Basically, the federal matching assistance rate was set when the program was enacted in 1965 to provide for higher levels of federal matching funds to states that had lower economic activity and therefore were the poorer states. So historically, all states were guaranteed that it would be a 50-50 match, but the calculation using a formula that has not been revised since the program was enacted because of all of the issues you've just heard about winners and losers among states has stayed at calculations based on the last 3 years of state per capita income with other factors. So poorer states get a higher matching rate than states that are not quite as poor in terms of their overall thing. But it's not adjusted for economic downturn. So there's been a lot of talk about trying to build in some kind of a counter-cyclical financing where there'd be an automatic bump up in the matching rate instead of Congress having, as it did in ERA, to come in and raise it up. It's a higher matching rate under the CHIP program for children than it is under Medicaid, but the base is still the Medicaid rate. So it's a historical way of trying to provide state matching funds with federal matching funds, but it does treat different states differently based on their economic circumstances, and lots of people will tell you there are probably better ways to do it. But what the legislation is doing is actually changing the way that the federal government reimburses for the new people that would be coming onto the program, but not basically changing the framework of how Medicaid is financed for its current population.
And just in general numbers, the average federal matching rate, not during this time of an enhanced
rate, but the average rate is generally around 56-57%. About one-fourth of the states are at the minimum level of 50%, and about one-fourth of the states are at 70% or above. And
geographically, they look like the southern tier is usually the higher matching.
Right. And there's a map in the report which shows.
Okay, we have another question on the phone.
Yes, as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, should you have a question, please press the pound key followed by the number 3 on your push-button telephone. Our next question comes from Penelope Lamov, Governing Magazine. Please state your question.
This is kind of for Vern. You had mentioned that overall Medicaid spending increased by 7.9%, but that the state share dropped by 3.3%. Could you amplify that and sort of, you said it was unprecedented on what the implications of that are?
In the report on page 27, there's a graph which shows both the state, the change in state funding and overall funding, and it shows that in fiscal year 2009, the state share dropped by 6.3%, and in fiscal year 2010 by 5.6%. The key thing to understand here is that this happened expressly because of the enhanced federal matching rate that was in the Recovery Act. And this is a one-time, unprecedented phenomenon that occurred. And what is going to happen here is that when the enhanced federal matching rate ends in December of 2010, in the middle of state's fiscal year 2011, there will be a corresponding spike in the state costs. And I think that's the big concern that's going to happen here. And states are already preparing their budgets for fiscal year 2011. They'll be presented to legislatures in January. And already state officials are having to consider what kinds of actions they're going to have to take to account for this huge increase in the state share.
We're nearing the end of our time, but we have one last question on the phone that we'll take, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bob Rosenblatt, freelance writer. Please go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask both the Medicaid directors if you have any evidence, either systematic or anecdotal, that cutbacks in personal care and home care visits may have already forced some people into nursing homes.
This is Chuck Duarte from Nevada. That was a key issue of concern expressed by our legislators when we were proposing a limit on certain types of assistance for activities of daily living. We didn't eliminate anything, but we did reduce rates and impose some limitations on the amount of available hours that we pay for. And we tracked very closely any of these adverse events that were created as a result of these limitations on service levels. And to date, and these were enacted in October of 2008, but to date we've not seen any admissions or any significant admissions that we could trace to a reduction in personal care levels of service, nor to the rate of hospitalizations. So, you know, knock on wood, that's something that we've not seen as a result of some of these limitations.
In New York, we approached our home care and personal care cuts as provider reimbursement cuts, and we did cut in both sectors. At the same time, we are reforming how we pay for that care and creating a long-term care assessment center. So and we did not cut benefits or hours at this point. It's too soon to know the impact of the programmatic and reimbursement changes, but up till now, our belief that what we've done is to better rationalize the system. Future cuts, though, may start to go beyond the fat and into the bone, and that's what we're most concerned about. So as Chuck said, so far, so good. The future is less clear.
Well, thank you all, the participants on the phone, the state Medicaid directors that we've had join us, and all of the authors and others in the room for at least a look at the situation in the states. I think you're seeing the baseline against which health reform will have to build, and talking about cuts in provider payment when part of the legislation also would call for increases in provider payment are really pretty critical issues as we look at how to make the Medicaid program a platform for reform. We see many of the stresses and strains that are being faced today that really ought to be addressed in comprehensive reform. So thank you for your participation, and we'll be available clearly to follow up with any questions if you have them as you look through the report and the material. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the conference for today. We all thank you for participating in the call. All parties may now disconnect.